case before the Illinois Supreme Court might change how companies can use your biometric data, like fingerprints and eye scans.
To say that people can't hold corporations accountable completely undermines the purpose of the statute.
That's Rebecca Glenberg, an attorney with the ACLU of Illinois. Plus, the HPV vaccine can prevent 90% of related cancers when given to preteens. So why are parents still hesitating?
Who knew there was a vaccine that could have helped protect me from HPV when I was 11 or 12, way before I would even be exposed to it?
Did you know? Mom? Dad?
And electronic monitoring devices like ankle bracelets are being used more often on people awaiting trial or on probation. Is this a good alternative for overcrowded jails and prisons, or a problem for civil liberties? That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. If you've visited any amusement parks this summer, you'll know admission prices can be pretty stiff, but that's not the only cost. You might also be giving away some biometric information, like fingerprints and facial recognition. That's what happened when a child from Lake County bought a season pass to Six Flags Great America in Gurnee, and the park allegedly captured fingerprint information without written consent. In response, the child's mother sued, and now that case, Rosenbach versus Six Flags, is before the Illinois Supreme Court. The case could affect a state law that's considered one of the most protective or restrictive in the country. It's called the Biometric Information Privacy Act, and it bans companies from using biometrics without user consent. Rebecca Glenberg is the senior staff counsel at the ACLU of Illinois, one of the groups asking the state Supreme Court to reverse the appeals court decision. She's on the line with me now from Chicago. Rebecca, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So before we get to this specific case involving Six Flags, can you help people who are unfamiliar with this topic understand what exactly are biometrics?
Biometrics are a particular kind of data that is related directly to your body, such as your DNA code, your fingerprints, the shape of your face, the characteristics of your iris and your eyes. All of these pieces of information are identifiers that are more or less unique to you and that you really have no power to change.
So this is like when I stick my fingerprint on my smartphone or it looks at my face and unlocks, that's using biometric data to do that then.
That's correct. And companies are increasingly using all kinds of biometric data to achieve various kinds of tracking and surveillance.
So the plaintiff's name in this case is Stacey Rosenbach. In her lawsuit, what is she alleging took place at Six Flags Great America?
Well, she says that her son went with a group of other students to Great America and signed up for a season pass. And the company took her son's fingerprints, presumably to ensure that the pass was not used by people other than the person who purchased it. But the company did not explain to the boy what they were collecting from him and did not explain what the information was going to be used for and did not explain who else might have access to that information and never asked him for his consent to collect the fingerprints and to use them in various ways.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously you're not a lawyer in this case, but you have been following the issue. I want to be clear about that. But so as this case proceeds through the court system, goes to the appellate court, the appellate court ruled that there was no grounds for a lawsuit because there wasn't a, quote, technical violation of Illinois' Biometric Information Privacy Act. Do people say BIPA or BIPA? I'm not sure what the acronym is there, but anyways.
We say BIPA, but...
BIPA, okay, good.
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah, I like BIPA better than BIPA. So anyways, the appellate court rules that it's a technical violation and no actual harm. Can you explain what that means?
Well, BIPA, the statute that protects biometric information in Illinois, specifically provides that companies who collect your biometric information, such as fingerprints, must give you notice of what the information will be used for and how long it will be kept, and obtain your written consent before they collect the information. And then the statute goes on to provide certain limitations on how and when the information can be disclosed and how it must be kept confidential. But that initial step of providing notice to the consumer and getting their consent before collecting the information, that's really an essential part of the statute, because that's what allows you as a consumer to control your own biometric data and how it is used and who has it. And that was what the Court of Appeals deemed to be a technical violation, because there was no evidence, for example, that this particular kid's information was used in some improper fashion or his privacy was violated. But we took the position that that's not a technical violation of the statute at all, that failing to give notice and obtain consent before collecting this information is really what this statute is all about, and is a very basic violation of the statute when companies fail to do that.
I wonder, is this the sort of thing where, you know, I'm sure we've all downloaded software or things like that, and you click that yes, I agree button. Heck, you have to do it for just about any website you visit nowadays. I mean, would that sort of thing have possibly cured the problem in this case if there had just been a terms and conditions that had to be agreed to? Or does the law require going beyond that?
Well, first of all, when you're talking about a minor child, you really are supposed to get the consent from the parent or guardian, because kids are not known for being able to make those kinds of decisions on their own. I think that it's possible that something like those terms and conditions might be sufficient if they were provided to the consumer in writing, which is a requirement by the statute. And the person gave their written consent. It would be unfortunate if the outcome of this statute is to have notice and consent that is as complicated and hard to read as those that are on apps and websites.
Yeah, I'll confess I feel guilty every time I do, but I pretty much just click agree most of the time. So what in terms of this case? Yeah, yeah. In terms of this case, what are the next steps?
So the Illinois Supreme Court has agreed to review the lower court decision. Everyone is submitting their briefs, and presumably the court will then set the case for oral arguments and reach a decision within the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, possibly as early as its September term, but I guess we just have to. I don't want to be in the business of predicting what the judges are going to do. So I want to ask you, Rebecca, what is at stake here? What could this decision mean for the BIPA law in Illinois?
Well, if the Supreme Court were to uphold the appellate court's decision, it would really severely weaken BIPA, because companies could violate those key provisions of giving notice and obtaining consent without being held accountable. Because what the court is saying here is that those violations are not sufficient for someone to file a lawsuit. In that case, one would certainly hope that the General Assembly would go back and amend the statute to make it absolutely clear that, yes, they do intend for consumers to be able to file a lawsuit when those basic provisions of BIPA are violated. But if that doesn't happen, then, you know, the goals of the statute are very much undermined, and people's ability to control their own biometric information is compromised.
That's Rebecca Glenberg, an attorney with the ACLU of Illinois. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
My pleasure.
On the line with me now is Jay Kesson. He's a professor in the Colleges of Law and Engineering at the University of Illinois. Jay, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Jay, and I'm sorry, it's Jay Kesson. I said your name incorrectly there. But we've heard a little bit about this case, Rosenbach versus Six Flags, but I want to back up a little bit. So can you give us just a little bit of background about our biometric privacy laws in Illinois? How unique are they compared to other states?
The Illinois' BIPA law is pretty tough. It requires you to provide notice. It requires you to say biometric data is being collected. You have to state what is the purpose that you're collecting that data. You have to state the length of time for which that biometric information is being collected. And then you have to obtain a written consent or a written release. So it's pretty stringent. It requires notice and a specific kind of notice and informed consent. Now, it also allows for a private cause of action. So it allows somebody like the Rosenbachs to file a lawsuit if they believe that they've been aggrieved, if they're an aggrieved party. Now, the lower court here said they've not been aggrieved because the information had not been stolen and, you know, that sort of thing, based on the biometric. But compared to other states, the Illinois law is pretty tough. Many states, for example, Texas, don't allow a private cause of action. States like Washington have exceptions to the notice and informed consent requirement. So, for example, you know, in furtherance of a security purpose is one of the exceptions in Washington.
Well, yeah, and so I wonder about that. So this would be like if a company wanted to install some sort of scanner on its doors or something. I'm wondering, what are the ways that people in Illinois benefit from having these protections in this law?
I mean, the real benefit is that biometric information is really different from some password or some credit card number that you can change. This is immutable. And so the fear of identity theft is real.
Yeah, so if I hear you right, I can change my password. If my password is compromised, I can't easily change my fingerprints or the shape of my face.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's unique to you. You can't change your fingerprint or, you know, your iris or so on and so forth. And so biometrics poses a greater concern when it comes to identity theft. And it also allows you to then, you know, once they have these images of you, it allows, you know, folks to pervasively track you. You know, you can keep track of people's activities in public and movement and so on. And, you know, so once again, the risk is real. And that was really one of the concerns why Illinois passed this law.
Yeah, I'm wondering, though, are there, so I get the danger, and I'm imagining that scene in the, if anybody remembers the movie Minority Report, where you're constantly tracked everywhere you go based on your eyes, right? That seems like it could be not too far off. But there are things we're missing out on, any sort of technology shortcuts. I bought one of those Google Nest doorbells, and it, you know, it says some features do not work in Illinois, and it had to do with facial recognition. Right. Are we losing out on cool things like that?
There are cool things. Yes. I mean, for example, Google has a arts and culture app, and the selfie tool allows you to upload a photo of yours, and you can try and compare your face to all kinds of art and images that are stored and see, you know, if there's a match and so on. It's kind of a popular, fun tool. Certainly, there are other folks who like to see their kids' photos in sleepaway summer camps where, you know, you get all these photos, and there's a company called Waldo Photos. So if you upload a photo of your kid, and then you can stay at home and you can see what your kid's doing, you know, and so, you know, that's neat. So there are certain, you know, cool features. Having said that, I think it's very important for your listening audience to understand that all that is being asked under Illinois BIPA is that you provide notice and that you obtain consent. That's all. It's not as if you cannot do these things. Of course you can do these things. It's just that you have to tell the individual the purpose and the length for collecting this biometric data and obtain some written release. And then, of course, all of these things are possible.
So just need to get it in writing, and then you can do what you want, it sounds like. We're going to have to leave it.
I mean, yeah. not quite what you want, but obviously, there's other things like, you have to, you can't just indefinitely retain the data and so
sure,
on.
Sure.
There are other provisions in the law, but it's not
I'm afraid
there is a blanket prohibition.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time. That's law professor Jay Kaysen from the University of Illinois, who's also with the U of I's College of Engineering. Jay, thanks so much for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you.
Back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. Over the last decade or so, law enforcement agencies have turned to electronic monitoring devices as an alternative to overcrowded jails and a bail system that punishes lower-income people. You're probably familiar with one of the most common forms of electronic monitoring, ankle bracelets that can track a person's location through radio or GPS. A Pew study found that the number of active devices in the U.S. more than doubled between 2005 and 2015. So as these devices are being used more and more throughout Illinois and the country, what do we need to know about how they work? In a few minutes, we'll hear from Charlene Grace, co-executive director of the Chicago Community Bond Fund. But first, I'm joined by Kara Smith, chief policy officer of the Cook County Sheriff's Office. Kara, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much. I'm a pleasure to be with you.
There's a lot to talk about here, whether it's the criteria for putting someone on electronic monitoring or the population that's in this program, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I'd like to start by asking about the origins of electronic monitoring in Cook County. When did it start, and why did it start?
It started in Cook County, at the Cook County Jail, as a way to reduce the jail population in the late 1980s when the jail was struggling with record numbers of individuals in custody, and the sheriff's office was then authorized by the federal court to run a program where the sheriff's office would identify low-level offenders that were in custody and put them out in the community on electronic monitoring.
And what sort of devices are used to electronically monitor people? Is it mainly
the
these ankle bracelets? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we have always used ankle bracelets that are they're cellular devices. So the technology has improved somewhat over the years, but basically they are cellular devices that that will alert if an individual goes outside of the range of their home where they're being monitored from. So it's much different than GPS technology. I sometimes think the public might believe that when someone is on electronic monitoring, it's like the Bat Cave with a bunch of dots on a board. That is not at all the case with the technology that we use in the sheriff's office. It simply alerts when someone either travels outside of their home where they're being monitored from, or if they have movement, for instance, to go to court or to go to the doctor or to their work, and they don't come back on time, for instance, it would provide an alert at that time as well.
So there's some sort of base station then in the house, and it's just like a range setting or something like that. Then.
That's correct. That's absolutely right.
Okay. So we reached out to several other county law enforcement agencies throughout Illinois to ask how they use electronic monitoring. In Champaign County, for example, it's only used for people who have already been sentenced for a nonviolent crime as part of what they call electronic home monitoring. In DeKalb and McLean counties, ankle monitors are used mainly on people who are waiting for their trials. Cara, in Cook County, about 2,000 people, I understand, are on electronic monitoring every day. Are most people who are on electronic monitoring on pretrial release, or is it part of someone's probation or a combination?
In Cook County, under the sheriff's program, we have 2,200 people on electronic monitoring, and about 98% of them are pretrial. We have a very small number of people that are part of it's called our boot camp program, but it's very small people who are sentenced to a deconstruction program in the jail, and once they complete that, they serve a community supervision part of the program for a few months. But the overwhelming number of people on our program are pretrial.
And the sheriff's office runs the electronic monitoring program in Cook County, but who decides whether a defendant will wear one of these ankle monitors in the first place? Is that a judge?
It is a judge, and the program that the sheriff's office runs is not one that's required to be run by law. It has evolved over time as a very important part of the criminal justice process because we have 22 people who, absent this program, would likely be in the jail, unfortunately. So it serves to keep the jail population down. But we've seen some in the sort of wake of the bond reform, which has been tremendously successful for the most part. We have seen some unintended consequences, and one of them is, interestingly, we have people that are seeking who would be on an I-bond, meaning they'd be out in the community on their own recognizance, but they seek to be placed on our electronic monitoring program so that they can get custody credit toward an eventual prison sentence. So, there's lots of pieces of this that we are tracking. It was always a program for very low-level offenders, retail theft, possession of a controlled substance, things of that sort. We have seen some very significant changes in who's on electronic monitoring over the past, 8 or 9 months, with a very large percentage of the people now facing more serious charges, including gun and other violent offenses. So we, we work collaboratively with the system stakeholders and, to share information, share what we're seeing in terms of how the population is changing, as we continue to work towards a more just system in Cook County.
And what are the thresholds for putting somebody on? I mean, are there certain offenses that somebody would not be eligible for this program?
Well, that's a great question, and it's the subject of discussion at this point. It was for probably almost 20 years, it was a very low-level offender program, and we have seen judges using it for more violent offenders. There is not strict criteria or guidelines that are out there for judges to use, but I think that it is being used, by judges for people who are able to post a small amount of their money bail, and then perhaps the judges want more, some more accountability connected to that person and their pretrial status. So it's, you know, we're seeing significant changes in who's on electronic monitoring, and we do our very best to manage a very large population of individuals in the community.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the use of electronic monitoring devices, particularly in the criminal justice system. We've been talking with Kara Smith from the Cook County Sheriff's Office, and I want to bring in Charlene Grace, co-executive director of the Chicago Community Bond Fund. Charlene, as you're hearing Kara talk about electronic monitoring, I know you and other organizations in Illinois have concerns about how it's being used. What are your biggest concerns with electronic monitoring?
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
And welcome to the 21st, I should say.
Thank you. Thank you. Our biggest concerns are that this is a very serious restriction on people's liberty. And in the case of the program that we're discussing now in Cook County, where the sheriff is administering it for people pretrial, this is a restriction on liberty that's happening before the person has been convicted of a crime. And for many people, it will be a more severe restriction of their freedom than after they're sentenced, for example. It's a much more serious restriction on movement than someone would get on probation. If they were ultimately sentenced to probation, and certainly if they are found not guilty or their case is dismissed and they're never convicted at all. It's important for the public to understand that for many people on electronic monitoring, they experience some of the same harms as incarceration in the jail. So in recognizing that, the Chicago Community Bond Fund will, if someone has a money bond that they can pay to get off of electronic monitoring, we'll also sometimes pay those bonds to get people off of electronic monitoring the same way that we pay bond to get people out of Cook County Jail. And we've paid bond to get people off of electronic monitoring because they lost or were about to lose jobs, which were often the reason that they were put on electronic monitoring, with the idea that they would be able to keep their jobs because they were unable to be in their housing for some reason. We found that people are unable to take care of their children. One of the organizers that works with Chicago Community Bond Fund, her six-year-old missed his first day of first grade because he didn't have movement. She didn't have movement, rather. His mother didn't have movement pretrial to take him to school that day. And we have people, a number of people right now who are very frustrated with their inability to get groceries for themselves and the huge burden that this places on everyone around them, their family members, their friends, people who aren't involved in the court system but who have to take up this burden of meeting very basic needs for people who aren't allowed to leave their homes. And that's something that we need to be extremely aware of, the cost on individuals, the cost on the wider community as this technology is expanded. And that's part of why we're fighting the expansion of it, and we're saying that if this is a form of custody, then the same standards should apply as when someone is incarcerated pretrial. You know, there need to be high burdens of proof to take away someone's freedom while they're presumed innocent. That's what the presumption of innocence means. That's the structure of our legal system. And I think that the misinformation, misunderstanding of how electronic monitoring with house arrest, as we have here, how it works, how it impacts people, that misunderstanding has led to its overuse. And if I could just add, too, I think it's really important to think critically about this idea of how we decide how to treat people pretrial. So Kara mentioned several times that the electronic monitoring program in Cook County has historically been used for people with, quote-unquote, low-level offenses. You know, we may have different ideas of what a low-level or a high-level offense is, and there's very little research about electronic monitoring and its efficacy. What little research there is suggests that it's only appropriate for people who are quote-unquote high risk, and as a way to move people who would otherwise be in the jail, out of the jail, onto electronic monitoring. What we do know is there's decades of research showing that when you over-supervise, you over-condition people who are quote-unquote low-level or low-risk, it actually makes them high-risk. Right, so it increases the chances that they'll be rearrested in the future.
Well, I want to ask Kara Smith from the Cook County Sheriff's Office. You heard some of the concerns that Charlene mentioned. You know, and the basic you know, talking about people losing housing and trouble with childcare and even getting groceries. But the thing that really jumped out at me, she said this can be just as punitive as being in jail. And I wonder, what do you make of that critique?
I have a couple of responses. First, you know, we work with the Community Bond Fund. We work with Charlene and her colleagues. And I would expect that if they had any cases that for which someone was having trouble with movement, that I would get a phone call. I'm accessible 24/7, as Charlene and her team know. So I'll follow up with her on that. But it's certainly, you know, we are responsible for the people that are on our program. So we do, to the best of our ability, grant the movement request to come to us. And, you know, with a very, very large population of people seeking movement, 2,200 individuals, contrasted with the, you know, just several hundred people that are on the pretrial services program that's operated by the Chief Judge's office. So we agree on a lot of points, namely the lack of any sort of evidence out there about what electronic monitoring you know, is supposed to do for people. It's, again, it was always used as a way to bring down the jail population. And but we are always willing to be examining and improving the way that we run our programs. And we'll continue to do so with our electronic monitoring program.
And I think people maybe who are not in Cook County or familiar with Cook County maybe don't have an appreciation for what a massive correctional institution the Cook County Jail is, and the high number. I mean, what is the, I'm sure you know off the top of your head, the average daily population there?
Today the population is 6,154 people in custody and another 2,200 people on electronic monitoring. So that's, you know, 8,300 individuals that the sheriff's office is responsible and accountable for. So it is. It's a massive undertaking. We are one piece of the Cook County criminal justice system, and there are decisions that are being made in bond courts around the county every day about where someone is going to be placed pretrial with no restrictions in the community, with some restrictions in the community, or in custody. So, you know, you know, we do our very best to be as progressive as we can, but always keeping in mind that our job is public safety as well.
Well, we've got less than a minute left. Charlene, I want to ask you, this is, you just heard, it's often pitched as, you know, part of a solution to a problem of either overcrowding or an unfair bail system. If electronic monitoring isn't a good solution to these problems, what else would you propose?
Well, we need to be releasing, in the pretrial context, certainly, we need to be releasing the vast majority of people with no restrictions at all or with very limited restrictions. I mean, the evidence shows that when we give people simple supports, such as phone call reminders, that's the most effective way to get them back to court, and that the overwhelming majority of people, even those considered most high risk by pretrial assessments, are actually extremely unlikely to be rearrested, especially for something that's considered violent.
And you have an event this afternoon. Briefly, what's happening at this event, Challenging Electronic Monitoring in Cook County?
Sure. So we're really excited about this event that we're co-hosting with the Center for Media Justice and the Challenging Incarceration Campaign, many other organizations. We're going to be looking at electronic monitoring in both the criminal justice context, pretrial, in parole, in the juvenile justice context, and in immigration.
And Cara, just a last word to you. We have about 30 seconds here. Any response to what you've heard Charlene saying about, you know, her desire to kind of overhaul the system here?
Well, I think that, you know, we have been a tremendous partner in the efforts to reform the system in Cook County, and we look forward to continue to working with Charlene and her colleagues as well as the other stakeholders, and doing the best we can to ensure justice is served for everyone that comes into contact with our system in Cook County.
Cara Smith is Chief Policy Officer for the Office of the Cook County Sheriff. Charlene Grace is Co-Executive Director of the Chicago Community Bond Fund. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. When given to preteens, the HPV vaccine can prevent 90% of related cancers. So why are only half of teenage girls up to date on HPV vaccines? Gardasil made headlines back in 2016 with an ad campaign that asked the same question. If we know HPV-related cancers are largely preventable, why are parents still hesitant to vaccinate their sons and daughters against it?
Who knew that HPV can cause certain cancers and diseases in females and males? Who knew there was a vaccine that could have helped protect me from HPV when I was 11 or 12, way before I would even be exposed to it?
Did you know? Mom? Dad?
What will you say? Don't wait. Talk to your child's doctor today.
That Gardasil ad was from 2016, but now the American Cancer Society is back with a public service campaign called HPV Cancer Free. They hope it'll be a bit less provocative. On the line with us now is Tarnika Manning. Tarnika is the Senior Manager of Primary Care Systems for the American Cancer Society. Also joining us is Dr. Doug Carlson, who's Chair of SIU Medicine's Department of Pediatrics. Tarnika, Dr. Carlson, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Well,
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Carlson, I want to begin with you. Can you tell us a little bit more about HPV?
Yes. So HPV is a virus which nearly all adults have. It is a virus which causes cancers of the genital tract and causes oropharyngeal cancers. So it's a virus that nearly every adult has been exposed to and has had. So it does cause, by CDC estimates, about 32,000 cancers in the United States in men and women, and about 30,000 of those are preventable if people are properly vaccinated as adolescents.
I think there's a misconception out there that only women can get it or women are more likely to get it. I mean, what's the truth there?
Well, it is true that the cancers caused by HPV are more common in the female reproductive tract, cervical and vaginal, and anal cancers. But men do get cancers of that, in oropharyngeal and occasionally penile cancers. But it's also a partner relationship that we prevent it in males. It's less likely to be spread in a population.
So what does the vaccine, the HPV vaccine, do?
It does vaccines. It prevents the individual to get infected by the HPV primarily. So that's why we give it at 11 or 12, so that it prevents the infection during exposure. And remember that exposure occurs in almost all adults by the time they're older.
So the idea is to get the vaccine into someone before they become sexually active to be.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
To get it before they're sexually active. And yes, so that is that at the time that they choose to become sexually active, that they are protected.
And that vaccine is not just for women either.
No, it when we first came out, it was given to females, but we've looked at the science and looked at the safety, and it is clearly recommended for both boys and girls at 11 to 12. And if they're not vaccinated, then through their early 20s.
Okay. Tarnika Manning, what is the American Cancer Society's campaign, HPV Cancer Free?
Yes. So at the American Cancer Society, our mission is to have a world free of cancer. And with our mission, HPV Cancer Free, we're taking it further by focusing on HPV vaccinations to increase the rates of preteen vaccinations to at least 80% by June 8, 2026. To reduce the number of HPV cancer cases by nearly 90%.
And this, I mean, you're looking at adults, too, because this vaccine hasn't been around for all that long in our history, right?
No, like I said, our goal is to increase the rate by 80% by June 8, 2026. And the reason why we picked that date is because it's the 20th anniversary of the FDA approving the first HPV vaccine. So, again, it hasn't been around that long, but there are also other vaccines that are relatively new that are higher in vaccine rates.
So, Tarnika, part of the HPV cancer-free campaign, as I understand it, is also making sure that doctors are presenting the vaccine to patients and their parents the same way. Why is that important, and what is the American Cancer Society doing to help make that happen?
You're exactly right. Not all doctors are as confident talking about HPV as Dr. Carlson is. We at the American Cancer Society work with our health systems and our providers to ensure that they have the tools and resources to have that confident conversation with parents to motivate them to have their children vaccinated. And that includes going into the clinic and providing trainings on-site with our health system staff from the front desk all the way back to our providers to ensure that everyone is giving a consistent message around HPV.
Well, I want to come back to Dr. Carlson now, and in a minute I'm going to ask you about your presentation to parents and how that goes. But first I want to ask, what if you know off the top of your head, what percentage of your patients would you say are vaccinated or are getting vaccinated against HPV?
Well, we do well in our clinics. We are trying to get it up to the 80%, and that's right where we are within our practices. But we've put a concerted quality improvement effort with information. Also, it takes two vaccinations to make sure that the kids come back for their second vaccination 6 months to 12 months after their first one. So we've been doing a number of efforts to make sure that the patients that choose to use our practice are educated and made it available and bring them back to get it finished.
So how do you approach parents when you are talking about this, getting, you know, this vaccine?
We just try to be matter of fact that this is a preventable cancer that happens in many adults, that if we get the vaccine now, and we're clear, we try to get rid of the stigma of that your 11 or 12-year-old talking about them becoming sexually active someday. It's a reality, but it's also something that parents and doctors sort of tiptoe around occasionally. We want to be matter of fact that this is something that will prevent this. There is that stigma. This is a sexually transmitted disease. And parents will say, well, don't you think that they might choose to become sexually active earlier if they're vaccinated? And there is just no evidence behind that. In fact, the evidence is the contrary. The families who choose to get this vaccine have no higher rates, and in some studies have shown lower rates of early onset of sexual activity than those who choose not to get the vaccine.
I mean, Tarnika, is that your understanding as well, that there's still stigmas like this around the HPV vaccine?
Absolutely. We definitely try to work with our health systems and our health providers to ensure that the messaging that they're giving parents is that, one, it's cancer prevention. So you're preventing six different HPV-related cancers by getting your children vaccinated with this vaccine. And two, it's safe and effective. You want to ensure that there are no proven side effects with this vaccine other than regular vaccine side effects such as soreness, a little swelling, a redness around the area that you receive the vaccine. So, again, making sure that, again, giving that message of cancer prevention and safe and effective, and, again, for girls and boys.
And Dr. Carlson, I wonder about that. I mean, we just heard Tarnika's talking about some of the side effects, which are pretty typical for any vaccine. But we're in a moment now where there is this growing, and I'll state an opinion, terrible skepticism of vaccines in some quarters. How is that a factor? Have you run into that sort of concern about just vaccines in general?
Yes, I think that is true. We are having an increasing number of our population that is saying, hey, what about this? When clearly the science and the evidence shows that while there are common minor side effects and very extraordinarily rare serious side effects, that we are preventing illnesses which cause death in children and adults.
Doctor, why is the vaccine still optional, I wonder? Why is this treated differently than vaccines that we require for things like meningitis or TB?
I think it is through the legislative process. It's clear that the public health is helped in all of these vaccinations, but the fact that it is sexually transmitted and other things, I think that the legislative process is affected by the same things that affect parents from saying, I'll do everything else but this. I don't think that should be the question, but I think that it is that stigma which we're trying to get rid of, that this is the same as the others, not different.
As you were talking about that, I'm reminded of what was it, 7-8 years ago, when Governor Rick Perry, who is now the Energy Secretary, the Federal Energy Secretary, who got heat for supporting, when he was governor of Texas, mandatory HPV vaccination of girls. And he later walked back that position when he was looking at running for president. Have you seen, Doctor, a change in, the number of people who are getting this vaccine, or the sort of political aspect of this conversation over the last decade or so?
Not so much locally here in Illinois, but it is something that parents, I think, are looking at and trying to decide. I think that is the public policy around sexually transmitted diseases can be hard for politicians, but it is a safe, effective vaccine which saves lives. We just get back to the idea that nearly 20,000 people a year die from what is preventable illness.
Yeah. Tarnica, according to the American Cancer Society, should everyone be getting this? Are there any reasons not to get this HPV vaccine?
So our recommendation is that all preteens between the ages of 11 and 12 should be getting the HPV vaccine. That is the ideal time to get it. As Dr. Carson said, you can definitely get it after 12, but we definitely recommend that it is completed by age 13. And there is no reason other then, you get it either earlier or later. However, you just recommend that all our preteens get vaccinated.
And I mean, this may be a dumb question, but I mean, adults, this is not something that adults need to consider, I take it, because as we heard from Dr. Carlson, we're probably all infected already.
It is recommended in certain groups up to age 26, but the recommendation by the CDC is up to age 21 for men and 26 for women routinely in certain groups a little bit longer. But the fact is that we're all exposed, and you need to give it before you're exposed. So that's why it's not recommended past your mid-20s.
Okay. Dr. Carlson, I just want to end by asking you, if you imagine yourself in your clinic, in an exam room, you're talking to a parent, they're hesitant to get their child vaccinated. And I imagine we may have some listeners who feel that same way. What's your pitch? Can you make your best pitch?
Oh, I think I think parents will, listen and say, hey, you trust me to come to my practice. This is recommended not by me, but also by the CDC. It is safe and effective. And then understanding that we understand they're sort of talking about your children progressing through their lives. It brings a lot of emotion. But let's get rid of that for a minute. Understand that even with safe practices through their life, they're at risk for this, and that risk puts them at risk for dying. And two simple vaccines now can decrease that risk by 90%.
Okay. That's Dr. Doug Carlson. He's chair of the SIU School of Medicine's Department of Pediatrics. We also spoke with Tarnica Manning, who works for the American Cancer Society. We've been talking about the American Cancer Society's new campaign, HPV Cancer Free. Dr. Doug Carlson, Tarnica, thank you for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Coming up on the show tomorrow, we talk about so-called no poaching laws in Illinois and other states. Some workers at different fast food restaurants are not allowed to get jobs at different restaurant locations. Same company, different locations, can't get a job. They might not even know it. The Attorney General is investigating. We'll learn more. Plus, we know that soy is king in Illinois. It's also king in China. And how is this playing out when it comes to trade? We'll talk to farmers about how this is affecting their bottom line and politics. And we'll hear about how small towns across the country are trying to attract more people to their communities. That's tomorrow on the 21st. And that is all the time we have for today. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, you can search for the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us, if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us at social media, write us a letter, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.